Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Turning Towards Life. This is Lizzie and Justin here for another Sunday morning conversation about life. We are Third Space. This is a Third Space project. And if you want to check us out a little bit more, you can go to turningtowards.life or wearethirdspace.org and find out all about us and our work in this turning towardsness that we are. We are here again this morning with a source chosen by Justin. If you're new to us, you will get to know if you stick around that we alternate the week of who chooses the source. We always have something to read, and then we see where the conversation goes and how we're reflecting on the piece of writing, the poem or the prose that other people have written. Sometimes we do it on things we've written ourselves, but this week we have something from Michael Foley from Life Lessons from Bergson that Justin has chosen. And Justin, thank you for always choosing different things that I would choose. And it's such a brilliant thing. I was talking to somebody the other day, Justin, about the kind of difference between us. And of course, there's like a thousand of them, but the way that you see the world and feel the world is really different to me. And so each time we choose something that's of our world, we lead the other into a different world too. And I love that about what's here and what that feels like it makes possible in the world if we could all be open to one another like that. So I'm really grateful that we can and that we listen to each other and we open ourselves into the other's world. It's very beautiful.
Gosh, I feel so excited as you say that, Lizzie. It sort of re renews my excitement what you just said about the difference between us. It's such a productive kind of difference, the difference between us. So we have many, many shared commitments and a long friendship too, but we also have this big difference in the way that we come at the world and what we see and what we feel and what we think about things. And it's making me think, and it's very deeply related to what we're going to read in a moment, this piece by Michael Foley, but it's making me think about how extraordinary human life is and how much there is that can happen just by attending to one another. And we see one another's faces, but what we don't see is the vast insides, and the vast insides coming in contact with one another. In a way, I think that's where life, all of life is in that interchange, is in our meeting one another. And knowing that there's much that we have in common, but so much that so there's so much creativity in bringing our worlds together and seeing what that brings. So it kindles an enormous amount of excitement in me to hear you say that, and it reminds me that that's why we have been doing this. This is our 365th week, so this means that it's the last week of our 6th year, and next week we will have done 7 years. It's the last week of our 7th year. That's right. That's how it works. It's the last week of our 7th year. So next week will be our a birthday for Turning Towards Life, our 7th one. So that's really a thing, and it still feels maybe exactly because of what you're saying, actually, Lizzie, is that the aliveness that's here that arises between us is because of, obviously, we bring sources, which is like a bit of kindling, or maybe a big bit of kindling for the fire of conversation each time. And we've found 365 different things, and there are many, many more to find. But what it kindles is a real kind of aliveness, sort of crackling aliveness, when when we get into the wonder of discovering from one another how we see things and how we feel about things. And so thank you to you for being someone who's so steadfast and dedicated and also creative in the midst of it. There's enormous creative energy here. And then also thank you to everyone who's around us, whether you're sticking with us over many years or dipping in and out, or you just landed here. Welcome, welcome. So I'm going to hold up this book. This is where our source comes from. It's by Michael Foley. It's called Life Lessons from Bergson. It's published by the School of Life, and Bergson was a philosopher, French 20th century philosopher, and it's a really, really excellent little book. I love it. It's full of gems, and I want to thank our friend Rob for introducing me to this. And I've sort of gobbled it up in a week. This piece is from the book. So, with thanks to Michael for writing so clearly and generously and making the philosophy of Henri Bergson and also William James in this book incredibly accessible and explaining it so well and so joyfully. This is called Learning to See What We See, But Do Not Know That We See. Our awareness of ourselves and our environment is woefully deficient. In particular, there's a tendency to see what things have in common rather than what makes them unique, the source of a dispiriting sense of sameness. Our categorizing tendency likes to put people in pigeonholes, then notices only the behavior that fits in with our simplistic classification and finishes by dismissing people as superficial, limited, predictable, and boring. The equivalent in relationships is to see only the irritating aspects of the partner and then to turn this into a final dismissive definition. It's a common event. It is common even to want others to behave badly in predictable ways in order to confirm our own good judgment and enjoy superiority and righteousness. A crucial function of the arts is to prevent or break down dismissive labeling and reveal the singular instead of the similar, the peculiar instead of the familiar, and the inscrutable instead of the understood. I have often been guilty of impatient dismissiveness, but recently, under the influences of literature, process thinking, and the gentle remonstrations of my wife, I have come to find even people I have known for a lifetime increasingly strange. And strangely enough, the fact that they elude me has brought them closer. My inability to understand them makes them more understandable.
Learning to see what we see, but do not know that we see. Our awareness of ourselves and our environment is woefully deficient. In particular, there is a tendency to see what things have in common rather than what makes them unique, the source of a dispiriting sense of sameness. Our categorizing tendency likes to put people in pigeonholes, that notices only the behavior that fits in with our simplistic classification and finishes by dismissing people as superficial, limited, predictable, and boring. The equivalent in relationships is to see only the irritating aspects of the partner and then to turn this into a final dismissive definition. It's common even to want others to behave badly in predictable ways in order to confirm our own good judgment and enjoy superiority and righteousness. A crucial function of the arts is to prevent or break down dismissive labeling and reveal the singular instead of the similar, the peculiar instead of the familiar, and the inscrutable instead of the understood. I have often been guilty of impatient dismissiveness, but recently, under the influences of literature, process thinking, and the gentle remonstrations of my wife, I have come to find even people I've known for a lifetime increasingly strange. And strangely enough, the fact that they elude me has brought them closer. My inability to understand them makes them more understandable.
Thank you, Lizzie. There's a bit, I was trying to find how to make this the right length, so I didn't include lots that came before, but there's a bit that comes before immediately this in Michael Foley's book, where he talks about ways that we go on automatic and how easy it is to go on automatic. And then this part follows as a, here's one of the ways that we go on automatic. And I thought that was worth saying. The sentence actually, Lizzie, that really stood out for me, because I read it and went, oh goodness, yes, I do that, is it's common to even want others to behave badly in predictable ways in order to confirm our own good judgment and enjoy superiority and righteousness. So I don't know if you've ever had, but I've definitely had this sort of sense where I formed a strong judgment about someone. And in this case, a strong negative judgment, which makes me feel better because I'm a bit better than them. You know, look at the way that they behave. And then they behave differently, like somebody who's I've known as being arrogant and aloof and unkind is suddenly incredibly attentive and genuinely kind. Or they remember something when they've, you know, they remember something about me when they, and I can feel in me the, what I've got curious about in me is the thing that arises in me that is really, really disappointed that that's what's happening, because I can't hold the other person in the story that I've been so committed to holding about them, that story starts to get a crack in it, and their complexity as a person starts to come forward. And it becomes the case that maybe this person is both this and this, and probably this and this and this and this and this and this and this that I can't see. And how much of my story about them then may have truth in it, but it's my story, it's my projection onto them. And by keeping the story about them really, really simple, I make my life easier, at least in theory. Oh, I can dismiss you, or I can, you know. And how much of that is me trying to feel better about myself, actually? Because the way that they're behaving also, that I've got lots of judgments about, is almost certainly something that I'm ashamed about in myself in some way too. A lot of the time, not always, but a lot of the time. So that sentence in particular has been a real corrective to me to go, oh, anytime I've got a simplistic cartoonish story about someone else that is very convenient for my worldview, I ought to do my best that I can to soften it. And it works the other way too, of course. People who I've sort of idolized and gone, oh, they are just a totally fantastic person. and then they do something that's really discombobulating, something hurtful or something careless or something, you know, whatever. And I have to, then I'm holding. And it's not really so much the right or wrong bit of it that I'm wanting to draw attention to. It's that, is that in feeling in me, the dynamic of sort of trying to shore up my own self esteem and confidence by labeling other people and fixing them, or maybe diminishing myself by going, oh, you are the savior of everything or something like that. What it brings home so clearly is that it's making people into cardboard cutouts. And that is very convenient in terms of having an apparently manageable world, and absolutely terrible in actually living, because it's exactly what you were saying as you were introducing, is that the vast world that each person is vanishes. So I love this idea. Maybe I'll come back to this, but I love this idea of Michael Foley's, that the less we understand people, the more we see that we don't understand people, the closer we can be to them. And to wonder about what is it then, if the thing that we're close to isn't the story about them that we have, the simplistic story, but is something more mysterious in them. Really, what he's inviting us into here is the mysterious life that I am, getting to know, coming into contact with the mysterious life that you are, and knowing that we're all unfolding all the time, which is why he talks about process thinking in here, because it's hard to see what that is to do with, but it's to do with that. And then it has me thinking about, if I do this with people, maybe I should do this with everything. Make everything, mm-hmm. allow everything to be strange in this way.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you just landed on the process thinking bit, because I was thinking, as you were saying all of that, about my own habitual ways, you know, my automatic ways of thinking about people, about things, about life. And this, the way he's positioning impatient dismissiveness next to process thinking, it just feels like a really great, I don't know, undoing of an automatic part of me, because I think I can be quite impatient and dismissive as well. In fact, I'm sure my husband would say, yeah. And I noticed that the less spacious I am, the more impatiently dismissive I am. So the less breath I have, the less kind of able to see bigger horizons I am in any moment, the more impatiently dismissive I am. And the more spacious I am, the more able I am to see people and things and life as process. And I think I dance between those two things, depending on my capacity and resourcefulness and how many hours sleep I ought to have and all of that kind of thing. And I love the fact that he's talking about art and what its function is, because I can also see that the impatient and dismissive parts of me is so not interested in art. Like, There's not, you know, there's so many narratives that come with impatient dismissiveness of not having enough time, or this being luxurious and we need to get things done, or and being somebody who chooses art and creativity over efficiency and productivity and all the things that we should be doing in speech marks, I feel is a very big necessity of undoing in my life that I have to attend to all the time. And I would put music with art, I would put art with art, I would put anything with art that's one of those things that happens that may or may not produce something, and which depends on the moment in which we're in and what arises inside of it. So this creative act, Justin, that you and I are in, this is definitely a process, that there's a backwards and a forwards, and we don't know what's going to happen next. And it's life-giving and exciting and enlivening and switches all the parts of me on that are to do with process and wondering and curiosity and life and being brave to speak and say what's here and letting that be enough without editing, without making it better, without doing something to it, without thinking about it beforehand. And having that source of life, that source of energy around, feels so crucial to then be able to relate to humans and the rest of life in that same way, that everything could be and is probably a creative act in terms of seeing people and letting life impact us. There's so many ways that we can do that. It's like a never-ending benevolence that's here that is inviting us all the time, if that's the way we choose to look, if that's the way we choose to be undone, or can see the possibility of being deautomated, that we could let life have its way with us. It's so, I just feel all of the opportunity in that, and also the freedom in that. You know, I find my impatient dismissiveness horrible to be inside of. It's uncomfortable, it's tense, it's judgmental, it's probably a bit mean, it's pinched, it's tight, all of those things. And then when I begin to think and speak in the way that I just was with you about creativity and process, the world seems to kind of open up and the horizons get very different. And I can see and feel things that are just not possible in the narrative of impatient dismissiveness. So thank goodness that that is there and that that's possible all the time, every day, to see that instead of impatient dismissiveness, as Michael's saying.
So, one things I'm thinking about whilst you're talking, Lizzie, is that our rigidity or our automaticity, maybe it's like the shadow side of something that really helps us. It does help that I don't have to think about everything that I do all the time, that my body can do things on automatic. Like when I drive my car, I don't have to think about movement. Like when you start driving and it's really clunky because you're having to think about everything. How does my foot move and my hands move? And eventually that falls away and it's on automatic. So that can be quite life-giving, but there's also the corrosive version of it, which is where we become automatic in places that we really ought to stay, things we ought to stay alive to. And I was thinking about art. A very dear friend, Anna, who introduced me to the work of an American abstract, I'm sure I'm going to use the wrong word here for her artist, whose name is Helen Frankenthaler, and whose work I'd never seen. And there was a piece of her art on display at a gallery in London, not far from where I was one day in Whitechapel. And on Anna's invitation, I went down to Whitechapel, and this thing is a huge painting. It's about 15 feet wide and about 8 feet high, and it's great big bands and blobs and of color, of all different kinds of color. It's not of a recognizable thing. And because Anna had asked me, what I did was I just spent an hour with it, just with that. So I got my back up against the wall and I stood and I just took it in for an hour. And what was most extraordinary about it was that I probably would have walked past it in a in a gallery, if I was, you know, I'd gone for towards the things that I know move me, and I would have seen that and went, you know, and walked past. But when I stood with it for an hour and just really, really slowed down and opened and opened and opened and opened and opened, it started to come forward in whole new ways that I'd never, couldn't have expected. So I noticed things like texture of the paint, that some of the paint was smooth and some of it had tiny, tiny bubbles in it, you know, really, really like it was almost frothy. So I started to notice that. And then as I stayed with it longer, I started to feel and see how it was like things that I knew, that it was a bit like clouds or like water or like a coastline or like whatever. And then when I stayed with it longer, I started to feel things that I hadn't felt. And I felt boredom some of the time just by sort of staying, but I also felt wonder and joy and appreciation and amazement and delight. And then at various times I felt very moved by it. And it was such a brilliant experience to let some art do that, to sort of walk up to a thing that looked like a giant bits of splashy paint, and then to leave really, really moved by it because I'd been invited to and because I'd been willing to stay and let myself unfold in the presence of this something that somebody else had put great care and love into making, clearly. So I've started to do that a bit more, and I did that in the summer. I had a chance, we were in Cornwall in the southwest, and there's an art museum there, the Tate St Ives, and they had some big murals by Mark Rothko, which when you first look at them, just like very, very, very big slabs of red. That's all it looks like. But I went and sat with it for an hour, and by the time I left, my goodness, it is anything but a big splash of red, as it turns out, when you spend time with it. And then I want to do that with people. And I want to start with the people I love, and I feel like I'm doing this, and go, you are never the impression that I have of you. The impression that I have of you is one way that you're showing up in the world inside me. So it's not that it's not true or somehow connected to something that's true, but it's only the tiniest part of it. The tiniest part of it that you are, and you, Lizzie, are, and my friends, my family, and other people I work with, and every single person is like one of those paintings is, and even more so because unlike a painting, which does get fixed. So I'm experiencing it differently because I'm changing, not because the painting's changing. So there's just one of us changing in that circumstance. I'm the process and the painting is mostly at the moment just kind of staying there. Maybe that's true. But even just like being in this conversation with you, I'm changing because I'm with you and you're changing because you're with me. And the vastness that unfolds in each of us, you could spend a whole life just learning and receiving a single person. And I think this is the thing that I appreciate about the first part of Michael Foley is here, this piece is that he's reminding us that our automatic tendency to go the other way actually just turns life into something superficial, limited, predictable and boring, and of course people into something superficial, limited, predictable and boring. So whenever I find another person, any of those things, it's probably a sign that I'm not paying attention in the right place, because they cannot be those things, not really.
Justin, you're making me think of this really wonderful thing I went to once, and I'm seeing it now in a whole other different way, which is that we were in Westminster Cathedral and it was full as if it was an open day for people to wander around and learn about it and all those things. But it was filled with actors who looked like they were mingling, but you never knew who was going to suddenly stop you and read you and perform a sonnet, one of Shakespeare's sonnets. And I think now I can kind of see more of the background of why they did this thing, which was a very different way of experiencing theatre, which was that it was part of an everyday milling around experience of being in, you know, like a museum-y kind of environment, which is a big cathedral, and everyone looked very normal until they said excuse me and made some kind of little relating comment and then launched in to a sonnet of some kind. And I feel like that's what this is really saying, that, you know, my automatic parts would have just milled past everybody and treated them like I normally treat people in a public space. And but I was on, once I got what it was quite a kind of secretive thing. I didn't quite know what was going to happen. But once I got what it was, I was looking at everyone like, are you going to be the sonnet reader? Are you going to be the one who suddenly blows me into smithereens because of the way that you read something to me that I've never heard or known, or maybe I know it, but, you know, it's like a something that I wasn't expecting from you. So everyone became an opportunity for sonnetness in that environment. And it was so brilliant. But also what it changed was I began walking around wanting people to be sonnets. So everybody was in some way almost a sonnet and until they were a sonnet. And I'm just seeing that in fresh ways now, that that's what everything is. Everyone's a sonnet. And if I were to listen in a way that they were a sonnet, it's a very different thing than, oh yeah, that's so-and-so and that's so-and-so and this is how this always goes. And it's just like a lifetime of recommitting to freshness and opening to that vast mystery that we just can't know. We just can't. And then we think we can, and then we think we can't. And I just feel really invited by this crucial function of the arts in preventing and breaking down dismissive labeling and revealing the singular instead of the similar. Thank goodness. Thank goodness for art, and how bonkers that it gets sidelined in the way that it does. And just feel renewed in my commitment to keep bringing it central and keep my faith in keeping on opening and opening and opening and being in process and seeing things as process.
Gosh, wonderful. It's making me think, Lizzie, also about, as you're talking about art in that way, and as Michael was talking about it in here, about the practices that we might each have to bring us into an encounter with art that would wake us up, so that we can be awake with other people. And a lot of what we get given to notice in ourselves, whether our encounters of things that could be art wake us up or put us to sleep. So a lot of music that puts us to sleep, and there's a lot of television that puts us to sleep, and there's a lot of there are a lot of media that gets us on automatic because we go, yeah. Oh, I know this, and it's very familiar. And then there are the things that we don't understand so readily, so quickly. They're not so obvious to us. And I'm thinking about sonnets years and years and years ago as part of a coaching program when I was being coached by someone who invited me to take up working with my own voice. I worked with someone who worked with sonnets with me, reading Shakespeare's sonnets. And what's something that looks like I just never understand this at all, or I understand it and it turns out to have endless depth in it.
Mm.
How you read it, how you inhabit it, just changes it. And then I'm also thinking about all the music I love the most is usually the music I didn't think was so brilliant the first time I listened to it. The ones I think, oh, that's lovely the first time, often disappear quite quickly, but the ones that really stretch me in have been the ones that have come to live in me for a long time, because I feel like they awaken me. And so we could have, and there's a my favorite, the series of books, the Earthsea books by Ursula Le Guin, which I've read 5 or 6 times, because every time I read them, something new comes out that I hadn't expected. And this week I went to see a film, the film that I love the most is a film called Interstellar by Christopher Nolan. And I've seen it 8 or 9 times. And every time I see it, something else awakens in me about love and relationship and humanness and time that I've not seen before. So these are my examples. But I feel like this conversation is an invitation into having in our lives ways to keep ourselves awake to the depth that's always there, so that we can cultivate in us this wonder. And then it can be wonder about the buildings that we inhabit, and wonder about the people we're with, and wonder about the park that we go into. And my friend Ben, who taught me to look up when I'm in London, I remember this. He said, look up, look up, look up. There's a whole world you're not even paying attention to that's above your head, not on the eye line. And that can also help us do that with one another. And the thing that we've talked about a lot is often the people with whom we're most intimate, with whom we've been with for the longest time, perhaps, if you've been with a partner for a long time or have long friendships or have children or siblings or parents, or that we can start to look at them with wonder and to understand that they're not the same as our ideas of them, and they're not even the same as the person they were yesterday. So what a lovely conversation. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. We're at that time. And thank you, Lizzie, for being an invitation into wonder always. I think that's why one of the many reasons why this conversation has so much life in it, almost 7 years in, is because of the way that you keep on turning towards wonder and possibility and depth and the mysterious unfolding of things. And it's a real joy to do that with you. So thank you to you. And thank you, everybody who's with us, for being with us. You can find all of this on the turningtowards.life website. You can support us there if you wish by metaphorically buying us some coffees, which some people have been doing recently. Thank you. It's so lovely to feel and receive your support for this endeavor. And if you want to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, that's also super helpful. Otherwise, just come back when you want. And we'd love to be with you. And we'll be back for our 7th birthday shenanigans next week.
Thanks, bye-bye, everybody.